Biographer John Farrell is the author of Clarence Darrow, Attorney for the Damned, which won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for Biography, and Tip O'Neill and the Democratic Century. A longtime journalist, he worked at the Denver Post and at the Boston Globe, where he served as White House correspondent and on the vaunted Spotlight team. His new book is Richard Nixon, The Life, a biography rich in new material on the 37th President of the United States. Farrell spent 5 years writing the book, interviewing old Nixon hands and uncovering previously sealed records that make the book, he believes, the definitive Nixon biography. Again, the title, Richard Nixon, The Life, and it's a great pleasure to welcome John Farrell to the roundtable this morning. John, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure to be here.
At the start of this project, what did you believe you still wanted to explore and say about the life of Richard Nixon?
I thought that there was an absence in American literature of a single volume, cradle to grave biography of Nixon that explained who he was in relation to his times, and would be a substitute for the caricature that he is. So he's sort of a cartoonish villain in our society. He's the guy that had to resign the president. He's the fellow that, as somebody said, that liberal parents used to scare their children with. Or he's the guy whose mask the bank robbers put on whenever they break into a bank in the movies. I wanted to get past that, and as a biographer, I wanted to find out who this guy was and why he was like he was. And it was an engrossing experience because he's a very complicated fellow.
Realizing the complications and realizing you wanted to get past the perception, there is a part of him that is cartoonish, though, isn't there?
Yes, you can't listen to the White House tapes without feeling revulsion at some of the segments. You can go to YouTube and hear them. Many of the so-called greatest hits are up on YouTube, him talking about Jews and gays and blacks and Mexicans and Irish and Italians. He was an equal opportunity hater. But that, too, was part of the challenge, was to try to find out how that person could also be the person who went to China, how that person could also be the person who was a champion of civil rights in the 1950s, and how he changed from being the champion of civil rights to the architect of the Southern strategy when he became president after running on a law and order platform. So it was, as a writer, a wonderful challenge, wonderful opportunity. I don't think I'll see another one like it.
You make this point in the book, but he transformed at a point in his life. He wasn't necessarily born this way. At what point did you see a real transformation into the Nixon that we saw in the 1970s?
I think because of, I don't want to get too heavily into armchair analysis, but I think that from his childhood, he carried this grievous flaw that comes out in some of his young adult love letters. It comes out in letters to his relatives, comments that he makes in his girlfriend's yearbook. That's just a horrible feeling, a lack of self-worth. An insecurity, a feeling that nothing I can do is ever going to get the world's love and attention, no matter how much I reach out for it. And therefore, I'm going to try very hard, but I'm also going to realize that the only way to get their attention is to lash out, is to show my paranoia, is to do the dirty tricks for which he became famous. He was not all that man, but that was certainly a part of him. And it certainly came out in times of pressure. And when you put him into the crucible of the presidency in the late 1960s and the early 1970s, very high-pressure time, despite the control that he was able to exert over himself, this flaw eventually came through, and he cracked and gave way in more ways than just Watergate, in many ways.
There is this ruthlessness that came out, right? How did that manifest itself?
Well, you can hear him on the tapes. The tapes are this amazing gift to historians and biographers. But you can hear him on the tapes ordering his men. You know, the press is the enemy. The professors are the enemy. The liberals are the enemy. The establishment is the enemy. We're not going to give them any quarter. We've drawn the sword. Now we're going to stick it in and twist it. I want more bugging, Bob. I said it to his chief of staff, Bob Haldeman. Isn't it about time that we started tailing these Democratic candidates? And by the 1972 election, almost everybody on the White House staff was running some kind of quasi-legal or illegal dirty trick campaign against one or more of the Democratic candidates. Watergate was a small segment of a widespread campaign of infiltration and eavesdropping, and it was just a matter of time before they got caught, especially given the character of the bunglers that they chose to do their dirty work. So that is how it manifested itself. At the same time, this is a man who could dream of 20, 30, 40 years of world peace and what he could accomplish by going to China. He could sign legislation calling into being the Environmental Protection Agency, the Endangered Species Act, the National Environmental Protection Act, OSHA, a wide range of pro-environment measures. He introduced or he signed Title IX. He did away with the draft. I mean, the list of accomplishments is phenomenal when you think about it. But he had this flaw. It was very Greek or Shakespearean tragic figure, as Henry Kissinger said during the days of Watergate. It's a classic Greek tragedy where the hero has a flaw and knows it, and yet brings down upon himself the very end that he most dreaded.
So let's explore that for a moment. Within 4 years of his first victory, political victory, Nixon was a U.S. senator and six, the vice president of the United States. You write, few came so far, so fast, and so alone. Talk a little bit about that so alone part.
He was a loner all his life. Again, going back to his childhood, he had a brutal father and a very icy mother. He didn't feel that he was a loved person either in his family or in his community. He wrote this letter back from the war to one of his nieces, calling himself the sourpuss in the family, and wondering or acknowledging that he was not an easy person to love. And that made him bitter. It made him clumsy in relations with other people. And he was an unlikely politician. He had a very few loyalists throughout the years that he would gather around him, and he also had brilliant men who saw opportunity by serving him, like Kissinger. But as far as a very close confidant, not even his wife and family, as he famously said. And you know, Bob Haldeman at the end, the chief of staff, said that Nixon had never shaken his hand all those years of working with him, being a confidant, being a close aide. Nixon had never given him that basic human regard, human respect.
And something so simple says a lot, doesn't it?
It does. There's a wonderful or a horrible, either way to look at. There's a piece of tape that's so revealing, where he's gone to China, and he comes back, and he's sitting in the Oval Office talking to Henry Kissinger, and he demeans his own greatest accomplishment, and he starts talking about how these kind of peace trips don't mean anything. The American voters are a bunch of sheep. They're so easily fooled by a picture of me shaking hands with the Chinese when actually it doesn't mean anything. And it's so sad to hear him say things like that. It's sad to read these yearbook inscriptions to the woman that he loved in high school and college, saying, you know, you were better off without me, and when you turned me over for other men, it was better for you and better for me. It's you can see how those who did love him, and there were many, could feel protective for him. And you could also see how the American electorate, who also, especially what he called his silent majority, who also harbored their own grievances, their own resentments, could identify with him. And he had this very special talent to reach out and tug on the threads in their hearts about grievances and resentments, in such a way that he was a very successful politician, playing on the fears and the dark side of politics as opposed to the optimistic side.
And so much of that, of his downplaying of himself and speaking against his his own action seems to be very much against the view that so many have of him of being the ultimate narcissist and egotist.
Well, William Safire, one of his speechwriters and later a New York Times columnist, said that Nixon was like a multi-layer cake, and that if you just ate the top layer, you would get one flavor, but if you started going down through the cake, you got another flavor, and then you had another flavor, and then another mix of flavors. And that's a widely shared feeling. Bob Haldeman used another analogy and said he was like a piece of quartz, and it depended on which facet you were looking at the time, the vision that you saw.
John Farrell is our guest. The name of the book, Richard Nixon, The Life. You write about in the campaign, the first campaign, and ultimately what he was looking to do. And one of the things that you reveal in the book is this plot to prolong the Vietnam War for his own political purposes. Talk a little bit about the machinations of that.
Sure. I ultimately come to the conclusion that this was more reprehensible than anything that he did, even in Watergate, because of the number of lives that were involved. And the scene was 1968. Lyndon Johnson had announced he was not going to run for re-election, mostly because of the controversy over the war. Nixon had gotten the Republican nomination and jumped out into a big lead over Hubert Humphrey, mainly due to the riots, anti-war riots at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. So Nixon always suspected that the 1960 election had been stolen from him by Kennedy and Johnson, and he was afraid there was going to be another October surprise in 1968. At the same time, Lyndon Johnson was feverishly trying to bring the war to a close before the end of his presidency for the reasons of his historic legacy. He didn't want to be the person who handed off this ugly war after declaring that he wanted to spend the last 9 months of his term seeking peace. And he gets this message from the Russians, and the Russians say, well, you know, we don't want Nixon because Nixon is this renowned anti-communist, so we will help pressure the North Vietnamese into peace talks. And the price for these peace talks is that Johnson had to announce an end of bombing, of all bombing. There was already a partial bombing halt, but an end of all bombing in Vietnam. So Johnson says, okay, and he and his advisors, both those talking to the Vietnamese and the ones in Washington, believe that they have a very valid chance at ending the war or getting some sort of interim peace deal before the end of Johnson's term in office. And then all of a sudden, South Vietnam backs out of the deal. They start dragging their feet, and the whole thing appears to the American public like just one more slick Lyndon Johnson political trick to get Humphrey elected. Johnson was known for having a credibility gap with the American people over Vietnam. And when this thing began to fall apart at the last minute, Johnson picks up rumors that the Nixon campaign is somehow involved, and he orders the FBI and the National Security Agency and the CIA to start using their surveillance powers on the South Vietnamese to try to find out what was going on. So he finds out that there was this woman, a Nixon official named Anna Chenault, and she had approached the South Vietnamese and is caught on an eavesdropped conversation saying, just hold on, don't go to the peace talks, Nixon is going to win and you'll get a better deal after the election. And so Johnson is furious, and he orders this woman, Anna Chenault, tailed, and he gets Nixon on the phone, and Nixon denies it, up and down denies it, and throughout history denies that he played this role. In the famous David Frost interviews, he's asked point blank, right, and he says, no, I could never do that. And what I was able to find was a set of notes which shows that Nixon not only knew of Anna Chenault's machinations, but actually directed it, the notes show him saying to Bob Haldeman, his chief of staff, keep Anna Chenault working on the South Vietnamese and of Johnson's peace initiative any way we can monkey wrench it. So that, to me, was a very, as a biographer, very revealing of Nixon's character. And you can argue back and forth whether or not there actually would have been peace that fall. and some Republicans say there would be, and some Democrats say there wouldn't been. So it's not really a partisan issue. It's more of a reflection of how incredibly stubborn the North and the South Vietnamese were. But as a biographer looking to Richard Nixon, the fact that he would put expediency in his own election above the possible loss of life, the possible opportunity for peace, was to me, like I said, more reprehensible than anything he did in Watergate.
He was elected to end the war in Vietnam, but obviously the bombing of Cambodia and Laos certainly enraged the anti-war movement. How do those incidents play into what you were just talking about?
Well, Nixon said that he had a plan to end the war, and the plan was basically to get the Soviet Union to intercede, as they had the previous summer, by promising them benefits in other parts of the world, what policy called linkage. He thought that if he could make deals with them on trade or on nuclear weapons, that they would, in turn, as part of the deal, would pressure the North Vietnamese to stop the fighting. And that very quickly, it became obvious that the Russians were not going to go for that for their own reasons. They didn't want to be seen betraying this ally in North Vietnam before the communist world. And so that was a no-go. So the one great standard for Nixon and for Henry Kissinger was that not the fate of the South Vietnamese people. It was that America get out of there with its flags flying, that whatever defeat we were going to suffer be camouflaged as a victory. If the anti-war forces had not pressured him, both on the streets and in Congress, I think Nixon would have probably kept the war going for as long as it took and really bombed North Vietnam back to the Stone Age in order to make sure that there was no loss of prestige for the United States. But the peace movement worked on Congress, began to elect people to Congress who were ready to cut off funding for the war. The American people just got generally tired of all this loss with no clear gain and wanted to pull out. And so Nixon and Kissinger adopted what was a very cynical strategy called the decent interval strategy, which is they went to the Soviets and to the Chinese and they said, look, all we want you to do is hold off Hanoi to give us a year, 18 months, 2 years to get out of there with our flags flying, claiming that anything that happens after that is the South Vietnam's fault. And some of those tapes are very cynical and sad as well. And that eventually is what happened. We left South Vietnam with 100,000 North Vietnamese troops inside the borders of South Vietnam, and really had doomed them to inevitable collapse.
Here's another psychological question, that given the insecurities that he had and the ever-growing paranoia that came about, what ultimately do you believe caused that through his time that brought him to the point of Watergate?
Any little thing could tick him off. He wasn't in office more than a couple of months before he had hired a private detective, his first private detective, to go around and snoop and eventually wiretap the members of his staff, members of the over at the Pentagon staff, and newsmen to search down leaks and track down leaks. His foreign policy, he believed, had to be conducted in secrecy. Otherwise, he would be betrayed by the Ivy League establishment at the State Department. And so he and Kissinger kept it very close at hand. And in 1971, you get Daniel Ellsberg releasing the Pentagon Papers, which was a secret Pentagon history of the Vietnam War. And even though that implicated Kennedy and Johnson far more than it did Nixon, who was hardly mentioned at all, he saw that as, a threat to his conduct of the presidency, his conduct of the war. Couldn't stay out of the fight, got into a major battle with the American press, lost at the Supreme Court, and became extremely bitter and decided to, he looked around to focus his anger on someone, and he focused it on Daniel Ellsberg, who had leaked the Pentagon Papers, and he brings in this bunch of clowns, really, clumsy ex-intelligence agents, and sends them to burglarize, the White House sends them to burglarize Ellsberg's psychiatrist office to try to get dirt on Ellsberg. And that's the first sin of what later comes to be called Watergate. And in fact, it was a very potent early original sin, so that it when Watergate finally happened and the burglars were arrested inside the Democratic committee, the White House can't come clean because they would have to admit this whole history going back to 71 of this kind of skullduggery. And then, even despite his triumphs with the Soviet Union arms control and with the trip to China, he is still so paranoid about losing the 72 election that he starts telling his aides, I want more wiretapping, Bob. And so even though there's not a direct order from Nixon saying, send our guys into the Watergate, as Haldeman said, Nixon was the cause if he didn't give the orders.
Looking at his post-presidency, do you believe, in writing about that time, that he ever came fully to terms with his tarnished legacy?
I think so. I think that in his goodbye speech to his White House staff on the day that the resignation took effect in 1974, and it's on YouTube. Your listeners can call it up and look at it. It's probably one of the most amazing moments in American political history, because he ends it by saying, "Never hate, because those who hate you only win if you hate them, and then you destroy yourself." So there was this amazing moment at the very end, this moment of self-recognition in Nixon, and it must have been torture for him to realize how much of this was his own responsibility. He did come to terms that if you look at him in the David Frost interviews, you see flashes of anger, but you also see the moments when he's talking about this, and he says, I gave them the sword, and they twisted it, and just the way that I would have. And over the years, he begins to make some rueful jokes about it. He's somewhat satisfied that by writing all his books and trying to advise presidents that he's made something of a limited comeback. I don't think he died a happy man, but I think that he died, certainly did not live the last 20 years of his life in total misery. He was happy with his family, with his children and grandchildren, and at one point got on the cover of Newsweek with a big headline that said, "He's back." So he did make some redemption. My problem with what's called the exile years is that he did very little for humanity. I mean, most of it was all dedicated to the recovery of the Nixon image. He didn't use his great gifts in any way to help either his people or the peoples of the world, other than acting as a diplomat, messenger between the Bush administration and the Chinese, which I think was probably the biggest contribution that he made.
The book is just fascinating. It's Richard Nixon, The Life. It is published by Doubleday. John Farrell, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Honored to be on.
Thank you very much.
Again, the title of the book, Richard Nixon, The Life, published by Doubleday. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.